It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Farm to Table usually talks about food that we're producing, oftentimes local, sometimes not so local at all, and some foods we've not even thought about before, one we don't talk about very much, wild game or game, such as venison, and especially if that venison is reaching our table all the way from New Zealand. Now, that's the unusual story that we've got today, and I want to welcome Mark Mitchell, and Mark is the president of Broadleaf. Mark, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thank you, Roger. Great to be with you today, and I'm looking forward to chatting a little bit about the farm-raised venison that comes from New Zealand.
Mark, so your company is based in New Zealand, and you work with people in New Zealand that are raising venison for export around the world. Is that right?
Yes, it's quite a good story. It all started back in the 70s when New Zealand was getting slightly overrun by the red deer population in particular, and the entrepreneurial spirit of the Kiwis, they started culling them in, for the meat for Europe, and then after a couple of years of that, they realized there wouldn't be too many left, so they then started capturing them live and domesticating them, putting them on farms. And that was back in the 70s, and here we are, you know, 2019, and there's quite a few deer on farms, about 850,000 deer on farms, and the product's now exported all over the world. So it's come a long way in the last 30, 40 years.
Well, New Zealand's not close to many other countries, and so you have to put them on the water. It works both ways. One other thing in New Zealand, you manage to not have some of the wildlife we have. You don't have coyotes, which there probably wouldn't have been as many deer if you had coyotes in New Zealand.
Absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Roger. In New Zealand, we very few predators for the stock, you know, whether it be sheep or deer or cattle, and so yes, no coyotes, nothing really that's going to affect them as far as that goes. So the numbers tend to grow fairly quickly down there. Plus, it's a great environment. You know, we have great warm, mild climates, and the grasses grow really well. So all the animals do really well, including the deer.
Well, now, were deer native to New Zealand, or did they have to be brought there?
No. Our dear old English settlers that brought a lot of things with them. They brought the English red deer because you know, they wanted to have something nice to shoot, and they brought the rabbit. They brought a lot of things. Some of them not so good, and some of them have certainly thrived very well in New Zealand again because of the no predators.
So when New Zealand was being settled and the British were coming down, they literally brought wild deer that would mate and started the red deer herd in New Zealand?
That is great.
That's amazing right there. When would that have happened?
Oh, that was in the 1800s.
So in the 1800s, we had red deer that were wild. And do the red deer grow all over the British Isles?
Well, yes, they do. I mean, the one they brought down to New Zealand was the Scottish red deer. And the environment in Scotland and New Zealand are very similar in many ways, and the Scottish red deer did very, very well in the New Zealand environment.
So these red deer, they start populating, and for rich people and others that they could go out and hunt and have red deer as they might have if they had gone back to Scotland and had red deer. And then at some point in time, somebody decided we can farm them, that we can sort of domesticate in that they're put into, I suppose, what are they, large fields with tall fences?
Correct. Well, what really happened, Roger, was the deer were out in the wild and breeding, and they sort of got out of control, and especially after the Second World War when, you know, a lot of the men were away, so there was really no one shooting and culling and keeping the numbers down. So it was pretty much at the end of the Second World War that the government had to step in, and they had what they call government colours, and they would go out and cull these deer, and they brought the tails back, and that's how they got paid, by the number of tails they brought back. You know, they got paid so many shillings for a tail. So that was kind of the start of the, you know, they were shooting them to get the numbers down. Then they started bringing them back to the carcasses, which were then, they found a ready market for it in Europe, in particular Germany.
So now the red deer, could you describe them? I don't know how many people are familiar with deer. There may be a few hunters out there too. I mean, we have white-tailed deer, and we've got mule deer, and we've got some other deer that we're familiar with here in the United States. Little small deer that are over on the coast around Monterey that are a different breed or different variety altogether. But so how would you describe them? I don't know if you can say mid-size or color or their antlers or anything.
Yeah. Well, they'd stand about 4 or 5 inches taller than a white-tailed deer, a little bit bigger than that, and a mule deer. They're in between that and an elk, which elk being quite big, of course. Mm-hmm. And they have the males, they have a really good spread on their antlers, not as heavy as elk, but quite heavy. And in the summertime, they get a really shiny red coat. And hence the red deer, that's where the red comes from. It's in their summer coat, not so much the winter coat, but on the summer coat, they're a very nice red color. And they're very hardy, and what's happened over the years is they've been very easy to domesticate. They don't mind the idea of being in a large paddock with tall fences, but when they got constant feed and you know, places where they can have their fawns, I mean, they domesticate very well.
So you're in New Zealand, and you go into these pastures. Sometimes of the year, do they have to bring hay or grain or something? And do the deer just run up to the trucks and, you know, as soon as you come in to feed them like cows might?
Yes. There's a short, depending on what part of the country you're in, a northern part of New Zealand is warmer and a little bit more subtropical, and they can grow grass pretty much all year round, so probably not so much feeding in the northern part of the island. But as you further get south, and that's probably where all the deer are, in the wintertime, depending on how intensive the farming is, the deer will be fed. Maybe they'll be fed crops that are grown on the property in the form of alfalfa or lucerne. And there may be a little bit of corn or maize used, but generally not a lot. But quite often hay and lucerne, alfalfa, is what's fed to them in the winter. Mm-hmm. And they do become very friendly when they know they're getting fed. They do that, especially on a cold morning.
Now, do you have a typical breeding program so that you've got the does that you say, well, we're looking for a certain effect on this next crop, and so you bring in a buck maybe from somebody else's herd to be able to breed them to get, I don't know, be hybrid bigger because it's going to be the same sort of breed, but is there that much genetic planning into breeding and raising red deer?
Well, yes, it is. It's getting quite scientific now. What's happening is that because we've been farming the deer for quite a number of years, there's a lot of data being collected on the animals, whether it is the amount of velvet they grow on the males, or the weaning weights of the fawns, or the weights when they go to the slaughter, I mean, you know, how much weight when they hook them up. And so, you know, there's certainly desirable animals, males out there and females out there that a lot of the farmers are now using in it. The genetics could be coming from a red deer out of Hungary. They could be a slight Wapiti elk cross. There's a whole lot of things that the farmers are doing to breed and grow the animals in this. It was what's really a really good environment for deer.
Now, do they do some artificial insemination then?
You know what? There's a little bit of that done on more of a specialty type properties, but on the bigger, more extensive properties, probably not so much. They really rely on Mother Nature and the bulls or the stags doing what they need to do in a more of a natural setting.
So in the now, do they have a certain season that season that they can become pregnant, that they're bred, and a certain season that the fawns are born?
It's interesting because, you know, we're in the southern hemisphere now, so the winters and summers are now quite different. So the rut or the mating season or the roar, depending, you know, with certain terminology, is where the males, you know, will round up as many females or hinds as they can possibly handle, anything between 25 to, say, 40, 45 females. Mm-hmm. And they'll roar and they'll fight off other males and they'll service those females as they come in season. And that's usually in March and into April is predominantly the mating season. And then the gestation period is that they'll start fawning mid to late November, and then just before Christmas or the end of December, you pretty much know you can see the fawns running with the hinds.
So it'd be just the opposite of wild deer in the States, I assume, because it's your fall that they're breeding, and your spring that they're having the fawns.
Correct. That is correct.
And then, at what weight are they a good weight for slaughter for meat and processing and export?
Well, I'm gonna go a wee bit metric on you here, but then I'll convert it back. But the ideal weight, what we're aiming for now is predominant for young animals, is 52 to 55 kilos, mm-hmm. a hanging weight. So, and that works out about 140 pounds.
And that would be the hanging weight, so the dressed weight. And so the live weight would, what, be 250 or something?
Correct. That'd be correct. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. And then how old are they about that time?
Well, this is where it's getting really interesting. Some of these animals are not even 12 months old. So they're growing. They're being born, you know, in November and December, and they're weaning with the weaning weights and their growth rates, they're being processed in September, October, November of the next year. So that, you know, they're just on it over a year, or so, just under a year in some cases.
So I'm just roughly guessing here that they're growing almost twice as fast as New Zealand lamb.
Correct. That's correct.
And so if you look at the pounds or kilos produced in the period of time, red deer would outproduce a lamb in total in meat. How about price-wise, how does the price compare to lamb prices?
Currently, you know, on today's market, it's probably almost a third more, just in quick numbers, lambs around $6-$7 New Zealand a kilo to the farmer. And venison is around $9.50 New Zealand dollars a kilo to the farmer on the hook.
So that part of it sounds like they're a more attractive enterprise for many people.
Well, there's some other factors in there too, Roger. One of the factors is that deer, as long as you keep, you've got to bring them in and wean them, and then you can tag them up and you can give them some, you know, vitamin shot and a few other things just for good animal husbandry. But the real trick is to make sure that they're getting lots of grass put in front of them so that every day is a good day as far as growing, and they've got plenty to eat. And as opposed to, they're not as labor intensive, so there's not as much involvement from the farmer point of view. All he really needs to do is, you know, have good fencing, plenty of good water, shade, and make sure there's plenty of feed in front of them. And these deer, they grow, and they just keep growing because they're young, they're lean, and they're trying to grow to their natural size.
Now,
they do grow very quickly.
Now, cattle and sheep, the males are often castrated that are going to be going to slaughter. Do they do the same with deer?
No,
they don't.
No, they don't.
And then they don't and I imagine that they're young enough when they're slaughtered, they're not starting to show, I don't know, flavor characteristics of what do you call the bull or the ram or the buck or the male when they're not much over a year when they are processed.
That part of their mind hasn't really developed. They're probably would consider adolescents.
Yeah.
They're not really getting fired up, should we say.
So, but when they're seasonal like that, and you're getting them, they're grass-fed, I mean, that's the way nature intended deer to be, and they're grass-fed. But then when you process them, you have to take them to a packing house that is, you know, turning them into venison to be exported. But your season, since they're all, how do you handle that? How do you get them slaughtered when you're not able to maintain maybe a facility and labor for 12 months because you don't have a supply for 12 months? How do you deal with that?
Well, it's interesting. The premium part of the crop would be the younger animals, and they'll spread out between the end of September through to January, February, and then at the end of that you get a run. There's quite a few of the females that we'd consider dry, that they're not producing anymore. So then there's a home for them, because you know, no point putting them back out to the stag if they've been dry for a couple of years. They may have passed their peak. And then there's the animals that get harvested for velvet. Well, some of those start dropping off, and so there's opportunities to bring those to the plants during the seasons when they're not so busy with the younger animals. So, you know, when you look at the whole herd, there's opportunities to process, you know, I would say close to almost 11 months of the year.
So you can keep a labor team working and keep them on full time.
Yes. Oh, yes. There's like a lot of these processing facilities, you've got your core, I would consider, you know, permanent employees, and then there's the ability, as you have to ramp up at certain times of year, there's seasonal staff that comes in and works during the peak of the season, but not all year round.
Now, I suppose the cuts are they very similar to like beef cuts, or you've got something like, you know, ribeyes or leg, and you know, all the do you refer to the cuts to the same name as most of other meat cuts?
You know, there are some. I mean, obviously you've got your choice, your primal cuts. You know, we do for this market, we do a lot of French racks. Which are, you know, from the ribeye with a nice long bone that mm-hmm. presents really well on the plates. And then we do a boneless New York strip loin, which runs down to the rump. And then we do a nice cut from the rump. So these are some of the premium cuts, plus the tenderloins. One of the softest muscles. It's not a working muscle, but it's certainly one of the softest muscles. You've got tenderloin, you've got New York strip, you've got French rack, could be a bonus ribeye as well. Then you've got all your shoulder cuts, for stewing and for roasting and things like that. And then of course you've got all the legs, and you know, the legs are a big part of a deer. There's a lot of good eating muscles on the leg, and because they're farmed and they're young, the meat's, you know, very moist, very soft, it cooks up. You know, when you cook it quick and let it rest, it's absolutely delicious, and it doesn't have a gamey flavor at all. It's very, very mild.
So when it's fresh, what color is the meat? Is it red or pink?
No, it's a lovely red color. Now, these animals, the meat's nice and red. I mean, these animals have been weaned off their mothers. They've been eating grass for, you know, 5-6 months. The meat's lovely and red, and the meat's extremely lean, because all the energy has been going into growing. The animals are so busy growing, it doesn't really get a chance to put any cover on as far as fat.
Well, New Zealand is, it's a long ways away from, I've been there before, and it's worth the trip. It's the wonderful place to visit, and I'm sure to live. But you're a long ways from your markets. So are you chilling or freezing to be able to have the life you need on the meat products to get it to your markets around the world?
Well, Roger, this is where it gets really, really interesting, and it's been important for New Zealand and you know, other southern hemisphere countries. We're so far away from our markets, and so we have to do an extremely good job of our processing and our packaging. and the way we present the product to the market. So what's been really driving New Zealand and the quality is that our processing facilities are like walking into a surgery. I mean, they're absolutely spotless. There's no wood, everything's stainless steel, everything's washed down, and so we have a very low bacteria count. So we are now shipping venison as well as the lamb and the beef all around the world, and we are obtaining up to 120-day shelf life on beef, 80 to 90-day shelf life on lamb, and 80 to 90-day shelf life on venison, chilled, not frozen.
So chilled, is it down really, really close to freezing, and then the 30s?
Well, yes. It would be 30 degrees or minus a half or 1 degree Celsius. So it's cold. The meat's very stable. The packaging is superb. And so these containers, and what we do is we bring them in chilled by sea. And what that does, it gives it about 2 to 3 weeks on the water, coming over here, very cost effective. And the meat gets to age in the bag. And that too helps with the helps when it's a very mild flavor, helps with the tenderness. And, it just really makes a big difference if you can rest that meat and let it age a little bit. And we do that while it's coming over to the U.S.
You know, I've heard other people say that before. They refer to kind of the wet aging of their product, that the transportation time, that it's actually good for it to be setting and aging a little bit. And, that sort of that process is taking. So how long does it take a boat to get to the west coast of the United States?
Yes. Well, currently right now, we're allowing about 20 days on the water. And that allows a little bit, a day or so loading at the New Zealand end and a day or so, if all goes well at the port, to get it off. So we allow about 20 days.
Now, do you land on the West Coast and then truck to the East Coast, or do you come around the other side and come up the East Coast?
Well, we're based in Los Angeles, and we use the port of Long Beach. So we bring the containers into Long Beach, bring it to our refrigerated facility where we break the container down, and then we ship on refrigerated trucks to locations all over the U.S. We ship from Alaska through to Puerto Rico and everything in between.
So you would load a truck in Los Angeles, and yes. If you truck it to New York, then what is that, about 6 days?
Cross country, 4 days.
Four days.
Yeah, two drivers. So yeah.
4 days, so just going around the clock almost to be able to do that. Now, I've heard before that it might be more expensive for the truck ride from L.A. to New York than the boat ride from New Zealand up to L.A.
Yes, that's a scenario we have to deal with. We're very fortunate we have a multi-species here, so we ship quite a few other items with it. But, yeah, it can be quite expensive depending on the amount of weight that you're shipping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I've seen there are some other products that actually are produced fresh, frozen in the U.S. and have been shipped by ship over to China for some further processing and then freeze drying and then brought back and then trucked over to the Midwest to be fruit to be used in cereals.
Right. Right.
And it just doesn't make any sense except that. It's a whole different world when you look at that. Now, that deals with something else I think you must have to face from time to time. There are people that are kind of concerned about food miles. You've got a lot of miles. How do you answer those questions when people are raising concerns about, the sustainability or your effect on climate change because of the food miles involved?
It's a very good point, and there's been studies done because, it's not only the meats, it's all the fruits as well come by sea out of the South Pacific. And I suppose you got to really look at the tonnage that goes on a ship, the number of containers, and the amount of energy that it takes to move that ship from New Zealand to the West Coast. And if you divide that by the number of pounds that are on that ship, it becomes a very small number, and then you work out the amount of energy that goes into and the amount of fuel that's required. The footprint is very, very, very small considerably smaller than, as to your point, is trucking around the U.S.
Are you seeing any trends in the and where the demand is taking place, that people are requesting venison or being especially responsive to venison?
Well, traditionally, well, yes. Normally, it's been eaten in the cooler months, you know, the fall and the winter, where people perceive venison to be, you know, that's when you hunt venison and where they've traditionally eaten venison. So the trend now, what we're seeing is the new chefs, the younger chefs, the non-traditional European type chefs, is that they see this as a really clean, lean meat that can be used all year round, not necessarily in the fall and winter. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing venison being used in see it often used in summer salads. We're seeing it being used in charcuteries. We're seeing it being used in obviously a lot more sausage and jerkies and things like that. So it's being used in a whole lot of different applications where it was never used before. And because it's farmed and it's readily available, you know, manufacturers can get in and get a program going because they know they've got a reliable supply. And that's sometimes half the battle, is letting the people know, have the confidence that they can use it, you know, 12 months of the year and know it's going to be available. Well, we've been doing this for 30 years, but, you know, we're seeing the market grow in all sorts of different regions. And also smaller portions, you know, venison suits itself for sharing and tapas type menus, you know, where the actual dishes are small and shared and they're having you know, venison dishes and that's where they start to see them.
I would assume that it's pricier than beef. Would that be right?
It is. It's a little more expensive than, well, you know, you got to clarify beef. I mean, are we talking Wagyu beef? Are we talking prime beef? Or are we talking, you know, choice beef?
Sure.
You know, I would say that venison falls in between prime beef and Wagyu beef.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
so it is specialized. Yeah.
And what about supermarkets? Are supermarkets starting to carry it?
Well, you know, you've got some of your specialty stores. I mean, you've got in our market, you know, there's the more of the top end. It's not in your average Kroger or anything like that. You know, you've got your Wegmans on the East Coast. You've got your Bristol Farms on the West Coast. You've got, I think, the odd Whole Foods carries it. And, you know, there's all sorts of different areas that really hasn't taken off in those areas. But there is quite a bit of retail going on with, you know, ground venison and ground elk in a form that people can make their own burgers or make their own lasagnas or do their own tacos or something if they're looking for something really lean and still very tasty.
Is there a nutritional benefit over their competing meats?
Well, yes, there is. I mean, you know, it's super low in cholesterol. It's a great source of iron. It's got a very good, you know, the protein. Obviously, the protein in there is a high level because of the lack of fat. You know, it compares very well. It's right in there as far as you know, we actually have a lot of trainers, bodybuilders, and stuff that buy it. And suggest their clients buy it as well. It's if someone wants to build a bit of mass, venison's really, really good because it's so low in fat.
So now you're bringing all of it from New Zealand. I mean, correct. Is there any scenario where they could start growing the red deer here in the United States and you could market it as well and offer an American and a New Zealand choices?
You know, that's a good point, Roger. There is areas in the U.S., parts of Michigan and a couple of places upstate New York where they do farm quite a few deer and they are processing them and selling them locally, you know, a local product. I think what's happened over the years that, you know, the hunting lobby in the U.S. is a very strong, strong force and a lot of those areas, a lot of the people that hunt don't really want to see farms, you know, popping up where they potentially would be going hunting. And I think there's a lot of pressure on that area that they don't really want to see a lot of farming. So I think there's a bit of internal pressure.
Well, in many of those cases, I know out west, they make quite a bit of money from selling permits to hunt deer on their farms and ranches. In some cases, it's more profitable than their livestock is to offer the hunting where people are going and harvesting their own deer.
Yes, that's correct, and that's something that, you know, people, you know, they come from all over the world to do. That's not necessarily Americans. They come from all over, and it's quite an industry in a lot of areas, especially in places like Texas and I believe Oklahoma and areas like that, where there's just, you know, big ranches and there's an opportunity to go hunting.
So back to New Zealand, are you seeing more New Zealand farmers that were primarily lamb or dairy that are switching enterprises and getting into red deer and, as an alternative?
Well, it's yes. The answer to that is yes. What's happened is it's been a wee bit cyclic where there was a few years ago we had, you know, over a million, almost 1.5 million deer on farms, and then you know, the market changed and a few other things changed. I mean, it was a lot of people went over to dairy farming, and so there's a lot of infrastructure in New Zealand already up, and I think what we're seeing now is that venison's been very steady for quite a few years now. I think we're seeing quite a few farmers going back into deer and will stay in deer because it's just the returns are consistent. The input costs aren't quite as high as some of the other farming, what we've got to do for dairy and some of the sheep. So we're seeing the deer numbers starting to come back up again. So we're back, I think I mentioned before, at 850,000 head, and that's growing every year now as farmers become more confident and retain more females for breeding purposes.
Now, is there a Red Deer Farmers Association or Farmers and Processors Association?
Well, the main one is called DINS, Deer New Zealand, and that's a really active group that's funded by the farmers. It's each farmer's levied so many cents per kilo on his venison, so much on his when he harvests his velvet, and so that money is funded to help with the marketing of the products all over the world and byproducts. You get quite a few byproducts when you process deer, and so that's been around for quite a few years, and it's they've done a stellar job in supporting growth and marketing, and especially in this market that we're involved with.
You purchase from the growers. Does your company actually own your processing facility?
Not in New Zealand. We have a processing facility here in our distribution facility here in Los Angeles.
So do any of the New Zealand farmers come up and have you show them around, see where their venison is ending up?
Oh, absolutely. They love to come up and visit and talk to the people who are using their product, and yeah, they really do.
And then how about the other way around? Do you have any of your big customers that go to New Zealand to see how the deer are being raised?
We've done numerous trips over the years, and we usually take a group of between 5 and 8 people down to New Zealand, and we just did one last year. So you handpick, you know, what you consider your best customers or the best potential customers, and after a week in New Zealand on the deer farms and, you know, just the scenery and seeing where the deer live and how they're grown and handled and the passion that goes into growing them, we bring our customers back, and they just love it. They love telling the story, and they love talking about how well how well the animals are treated, and that's reflected in the quality and consistency of the product. So we get quite a few ambassadors coming back out of New Zealand that become really good salespeople for us.
Well, Mark, I'll bet we have some people listening that would like to become a customer so that they could have you bring them to New Zealand so they could see for themselves. If they just want to know more about it, know more about either your products or New Zealand Red Deer, is there a place online that they can get more information or get more ideas about venison is available?
Well, there's a couple of sites. DINS, which is Deer New Zealand, they have a website, Broadleaf, which is obviously, you know, we're a commercial, but we have a Broadleaf game. It also has a website. And also there's another site, Beef and Lamb, or New Zealand has a site which talks about the beef and the lamb. And Savannah, now there's an appellation that was put together by DINS New Zealand, and Savannah means natural tender venison. And probably 90% of all the venison that's sold in the U.S. is Savenna, and it's a special. It comes from certain farms, and there's certain animals at a certain age that fit all the criteria of Savenna. And there's a great story about Savenna. That's spelled C-E-R-V-E-N-A, and that's and Savenna.com, so you can look that up as well. That gives you a really good insight onto how these deer are raised and the farmers and the environment they're in.
Boy, it sounds really good. I appreciate your taking the time to give us this whole story, because when we talk about farm to table, we've not used to thinking about saying actually like venison or red deer from New Zealand to all over the world to tables around the world. And thanks for explaining this to us and telling a story. I'm looking forward to having some venison and keeping an eye out for the restaurants that have it available the next time I'm out and around. But Mark Mitchell, president of Broadleaf, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
You're welcome, Roger. Thank you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.